And Radio Derb is on the air. Yes, this is your solicitously genial host, John Derbyshire, with another edition of the world's best-loved podcast. Many listeners have emailed in with anxious queries about our new location and the fate of my eager young research assistants, Mandy, Candy and Brandy. At present, I can only tell you that matters are rather up in the air. We are broadcasting from a makeshift studio set up here on my own estates in Long Island, but the expenses of relocation, investing in new equipment and so on, have imposed constraints. Not to mince words, dear listeners, but no longer being under Tucky's patronage, and with my family and my domestic staff to support, money is tight. Do you have any idea how much pool boys demand nowadays? We shall do our best to restore the Radio Derb facilities to their former grandeur, but I have warned the girls that there may be pink slips in their future. All help will, of course, be most gratefully received. There is a donation page on the vdare.com website. I shall keep you apprised of future developments. In the meantime, let's get to the week's news. The big news item this week was, of course, Thursday evening's debates among the leading Republican presidential candidates. I missed the first debate, which featured the seven lowest polling candidates, but I read up on it afterwards. I did watch the second debate, and I'll start off this week with some debate notes. A key phrase in immigration discussions, one that I've deployed myself many times, is the one popularised by the late great Enoch Powell, who leaned hard on it when talking about the subject. The phrase is, numbers are of the essence. Nobody cares if 10,000 Mexicans settle in the USA. If 10 million settle, a lot of Americans care, and quite rightly so. Numbers are of the essence. I think it's time we applied that key phrase to presidential candidate debates. A debate between three or four contenders is manageable and instructive. Thursday evening's main event demonstrated that a debate with 10 participants does not work. 10 is too many. Numbers are of the essence. Aside from the difficulty of remembering who said what and who's a governor, who's a senator, who's the libertarian guy, who's the evangelical preacher, apart from that difficulty, they just don't get enough time to say anything. 1 minute for answers, 30 seconds for follow-ups, 30 seconds for a closing statement. Come on, it takes me 30 seconds to clear my throat and focus my eyes. All right, I'm a geezer, but not many of these guys are spring chickens. Median age up there on stage for the main event was 56. Trump, whom everyone was watching, is 69. He gets maximum Social Security next year. Four of those 10 guys are over 60. Later this month, after Mike Huckabee's birthday, it'll be 5. And in this particular case, those 30 and 60 second limits matter more than normally. The actual things the candidates say, of course, matter, but less so than before. A key feature of the current public mood is scepticism about professional politicians and their promises. Of course, we all take politicians' promises with a grain of salt, and we always have, but this election cycle is at peak cynicism. A big part of that is the immigration issue. It's dawned on a lot of Americans that managing the matter of who gets to settle in your country shouldn't really be a difficult thing with modern technology. Yet our political classes seem chronically unwilling to do it. And yet, while their unwillingness becomes ever more glaringly obvious, they still chirrup at us about securing the border. So, much more than usual, we're inclined to discount the words that come out of these guys' mouths and focus our interest on whether there's any chance they will actually do what they say they're going to do. We're scrutinising character, and that's hard to do when they're being given to us in short bursts. So, format-wise, low marks from Derb here. We weren't going to learn much from these people in 30 and 60 second sound bites. The thing we all wanted to know from the main debate was, would Donald Trump self-destruct? It was on the cards. This was a new format for Trump, and he's been showing signs of nervousness. He's also got a fine line to walk. His success so far has been as the candidate who isn't a politician, the anti-politics candidate. That's gotten him great poll numbers from people who think politicians are out of touch. Trump's polling numbers are especially good among non-college graduates, people in industries like construction who've seen their jobs swallowed up by mass immigration. There's a ceiling on that appeal, though, and it's not a high enough ceiling to get Trump elected president. The paradox of his position is that to break through that ceiling, he needs to come across as more of a politician. As fed up as we all are with professional polls, we have certain deep expectations of the people we hire to do work for us. If I hire in a roofer to fix the leak in my garage, I'm not pleased if he shows up in a leopard skin jumpsuit with his hair dyed turquoise. The generality of voters, especially middle class, college educated voters, expect a certain demeanour from people running for office. They expect some gravitas. Let's face it, Trump has a gravitas deficit. That's the fork that he's in. If he ramps up the gravitas, the voters currently cheering him on might start thinking, oh, he's just like the other damn polls after all, and fall away. If he stays the bad boy candidate, he's stuck under that ceiling. And that's where he's still stuck after Thursday night's debate. Trump fortified the credentials that he's already got. He owned up frankly to his willingness to run third party. No shucking and jiving there. He unashamedly admitted strategic use of the bankruptcy laws. Ditto about making political contributions all over. He jeered at Megyn Kelly's blathering about some absurd war on women, where a professional poll would have run for cover. All good stuff, and I love Trump for it. He has to find a way through that ceiling, though. My advice to Trump would be to work gradually, cautiously towards the expectations of gravitas over the next few months, but avoid sudden changes. In future debates, he should continue to be the spoiler and the mocker, but tone down the bumptiousness just a tick or two each time. The national question didn't get as much of an airing as I'd hoped in Thursday night's debates. Unless I missed something, birthright citizenship, chain migration, affirmative action for immigrants, an immigration moratorium, and the status of Puerto Rico all went unmentioned. I conclude that the national question is still radioactive. Legal immigration went almost completely unmentioned. The exception here was Rick Santorum, who said he'd reduce legal immigration by 25%. That counts as sensationally bold in the milk and water apologetics that passes for public conversation about immigration, but it's actually rather feeble. What's really needed is a moratorium. Still, credit to Santorum for even venturing that close to the plutonium. Here's a question nobody was asked in these debates, and that I guarantee nobody will be asked in future debates. Suppose congressional leaders agreed to a moratorium on all immigration for settlement and all guest worker visas, like H-1Bs, with sensible, tightly defined, necessary exceptions. In return for a blanket amnesty on persons currently here illegally. Would you approve that deal? Now that's a real immigration question, a real meaty bit of political decision-making to confront a candidate with. I can think of half a dozen similar. Another example, Puerto Rico is, in all but name, a colony of the USA. Should we really be in the colonialism business? Why shouldn't Puerto Rico be independent? Questions like these, frank, reasonable questions about our nation, about its very nature, about what it'll be like for our grandchildren to live in, these questions can't be raised. The acceptable zone of public discourse is too narrow, too constrained, too constipated. Instead, watching these debates, you hear college radical gibberish from the questioners about a war on women, and empty assurances from the candidates that they will secure the border. Scott Walker actually said that on Thursday, quote, "I believe we need to secure the border," end quote. Sure you do, Governor. Sure you do, sure. Not even Donald Trump mentioned legal immigration. The reason for this narrowness isn't hard to find. Both the ideological left and the major business lobbies have harnessed the earnest moralistic tendencies in American culture to their own purposes. Denying settlement rights to persons who want to settle here would be unkind. If you want to do that, you are a bad person. Behind all the moralistic flim-flam, you can, if you listen carefully, hear the ker-ching of cash registers and the low murmur of Trotskyite study groups. But most people don't listen that carefully. So, not much here for immigration patriots. Just a few mopping up notes here from my debate jottings. Again, to the issue of numbers and timing. Talking on your feet, it's easy to say dumb things. When you're talking on your feet under pressure like that, it's double easy, even for experienced speakers. So there were a few say what moments. Rand Paul, for example, told us that, quote, "The Fourth Amendment was what we fought the revolution over." Well, you sort of know what he meant, but the senator needs to check his dates there. Revolution ended in 1783. Bill of Rights, 1789. And then Donald Trump, quote, "We don't beat Japan with their millions and millions of cars coming into this country in trade," end quote. where Japanese cars flooding into America was a great candidate talking point 40 years ago. But time moves on, Donald. That's all forgivable where the individual speakers are concerned, but again, the format really didn't help. A different point. It's always worth thinking about the vice presidency when watching these things. A lot of these people, especially down at the no-hoper level, are trying not so much for the top spot on the ticket as the second one. Being vice president is a pretty nice gig. You get a car and stuff, and you have a fair shot at parlaying vice president into president. So, a no-hoper for the top spot, but who comes over decently well in the debates, can hope for that. A couple of them were almost visibly doing so. Bobby Jindal and Carly Fiorina. It helps that we're probably moving into an era where it'll be seen as absolutely necessary for one of the two faces on the ticket to be either non-white or female. With that in mind, I was looking for Ben Carson to register as one of the vice presidential aspirants. In the event, he didn't register as anything much. Carson seems like a very nice chap, and he's welcome to dinner at my gaff any time. But he's out of his depth in politics. God wants a flat tax? Say what? The other 14 contenders in Thursday's debates are all pale and male. So Jindal, who's brown, and Fiorina, who has ovaries, are good prospects for the VP slot. If you want to put money on that, I'd say go for Jindal. So much for Thursday night's debates. Now, by way of punctuation, here is a sort of non-segment. A Seinfeld show segment. A segment about nothing. Well, not really about nothing. It's actually about the diplomatic agreement reached on July 14th in Vienna over Iran's nuclear weapons development between Iran and the Six Nation negotiating squad. I just have nothing to say that I haven't said before. Was this agreement newsy? I guess it was. And when Radio Derb returned to the pod waves last week, a lot of listeners were expecting us to pronounce on it. When we didn't, I got disappointed emails. Just in hopes of quelling the emails, I'm going to replay here my remarks about this issue from our last April 4th podcast. My views haven't changed. Quote, I'm fatalistic about nuclear proliferation. With Pakistan and North Korea already nuclear, why should I believe that Iran getting a bomb adds anything significant to my chance of being nuked or EMP'd? If we wanted to stop crazy nations from getting nukes, the time to do it was 20 years ago. That ship has sailed. My nuclear policy for the USA would consist of 1. Having far more nukes than anyone else on the planet. 2. Having really good signature technology for determining where a nuke originated. And 3. Making sure that all the world's troublemakers know about 1 and 2. I really don't see that Iranian nukes are any of our business. We're coming up to the 400th anniversary of the outbreak of the 30 Years' War in Europe in 1618. That was a terrible conflict, driven by religious and national passions. Steven Pinker, in his book about violence through history, gives the death toll at 7 million, equivalent to 32 million today. Plainly, the Middle East, which in its political development is running about 400 years behind Europe,
Plainly, they're heading for some similar catastrophe. If nukes are deployed, 32 million dead is probably about right, although perhaps somewhat on the low side. Europe survived the 30 Years' War, and the Middle East will survive whatever's brewing up between Sunnis and Shias. Do we have a dog in this fight? Or, as my friend Andrew Stutterford says, do we have a god in this fight? I don't see it. Given the stupidity of our politicians, if we do get involved, we'll screw it up somehow, as we did Vietnam and Iraq. Let's just stay the heck out of the whole stinking snake pit. Am I missing something? Speaking of things nuclear, Thursday this week was also the 70th anniversary of the atom bomb being dropped on Hiroshima. As I'm sure listeners all know, 3 days later, a second atom bomb was dropped on Nagasaki. The bombs killed some number between 70 and 120,000 people immediately. Some similar additional number died in the next 3 months, and some unknown but probably similar number again died in the months and years following. In the 70 years, less 3 days, since the Nagasaki bomb, no nuclear weapons have been used by anyone, anywhere. That's a remarkable thing. How about the next 70 years? Is our run of nuclear-free luck going to continue? There are good reasons to doubt it. Since Hiroshima, we've gone from one nuclear nation to nine. At least six of the nine, Israel, Pakistan and North Korea are uncertain, at least six are thermonuclear, which is to say they have hydrogen bombs as well as atom bombs. On a linear extrapolation, 70 years further on, there'll be 18. But, of course, one should never assume linearity. The correct extrapolation might be exponential. This is, after all, 1940s technology we're talking about. Like valve radios, ferrite core computers, and car windows that you wind down with a handle. For all we know, there may be some breakthrough in physics or robotics next week that means you can make a nuke in your garage. And there's the complacency trap. In New York City right now, we're going through a crime wave. The last one was back in the early 90s. New Yorkers reacted by electing two no-nonsense, business-like mayors who got the crime rate down and kept it down. That made New Yorkers complacent. They forgot the bad times and elected a cop-hating left liberal mayor. So now we're back with rising crime. The complacency trap. Some things need eternal vigilance. But unfortunately, humankind is not very good at eternal vigilance. So this coming 70 years, my bet is we'll see a couple of cities go poof here and there. Please, let it not be here. Which brings us back to immigration, to border control and rights of settlement, which in turn brings us right back to the complacency trap. Health tip of the week. Some of the worst effects of radiation sickness can be alleviated by doses of potassium iodide. You can buy potassium iodide from Amazon.com in 65 milligram tablets with a 5-year expiration. They're not expensive. Buy some. Put them in your medicine cabinet. New York City crime. Ah, yes. Let me just ask you, does your cynicism about the reporting of race and crime need a booster shot? Well, that's what Radio Derb's here for. I'm looking at the New York Police Department Daily Blotter here in the August 6th edition of the New York Post. What have we got? Altogether, there are 7 crime stories on the blotter. In descending order of heinousness, heinosity, whatever, a home invasion with robbery and assault on an elderly woman, an attempted rape, a non-fatal shooting, 2 store robberies, an arrested turnstile jumper who struggled free from the arresting officer and escaped, and then last and, yes, least, a bicycle rider who shoved a bus driver with his bike when the driver wouldn't let it on board the bus. Number of perps there? 12. 11 male and 1 female. 7 of those 12 perps appear in security camera photos. Unfortunately, the photos are poor quality. Just from the photos, 2 of the perps are clearly black. The others could be any race. But hey, they'll fill out that information in the stories for us, right? Nope. In 700 words of reporting, the race of a perp is mentioned only once. Thus, quote, "The suspect is described as a white male, approximately 5'9", with short blonde hair and wearing a grey t-shirt and white shorts." End quote. That white male was the cyclist who shoved his bike at the bus driver, leaving the traumatised bus driver with, quote, "bruises and scratches." Compare the description of the woman in one of the store robberies, quote, "A woman, approximately 5'6" and in her mid-30s, wearing a black t-shirt, multicoloured sneakers and leggings." End quote. No, I didn't cherry-pick Thursday's crime blotter from a week's worth. It was just convenient to hand, and the statistics there are perfectly routine. As I said, any time your cynicism about media crime reporting needs a recharge, we're here for you. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. It's been far too long since we ran a story on the Miss Bum Bum pageant, held in Brazil every year to select the lady with that nation's most pulchritudinous posterior, most delectable derriere, most glamorous glutes, handsomest hiney. Well, work your own alliterations here. Yes, bottoms are very big in Brazil. The actual pageant takes place in November, so, as with our own much less enthralling presidential election, it's early days yet. Unlike our presidential contest, there is so far no contestant coming out of left field, shaking up the establishment candidates by saying outrageous things and racking up jaw-dropping poll numbers. If there were one, presumably her name would be Donaldina Rump. And of course, if other contestants felt insulted by her comments, the dignified thing to do would be to turn the other cheek. Anyway, while the pageant itself is still 3 months away, hopeful contestants from Brazil's various regions have already been putting their best foot forward. Although that can't possibly be the right expression. In the streets of São Paulo. Quote from the Daily Mail, Britain's newspaper of record. Quote, "Bending down to allow plenty of photos of their peachy behinds, The models were busy raising awareness of the start of the online voting stage of the competition. The public must decide which of the 27 women will be allowed to compete in the November final. Competition is fierce, as only 15 of the buxom beauties will be allowed to take part in the final. End quote. Let's just hope this year's Miss Bum Bum pageant will maintain a properly elevated tone and not be marred by any incidents of bad taste such as occurred last year. Based on the pictures in the Daily Mail of the ladies taking a crack at the Miss Bum Bum title, I'd say that Miss Mato Grosso has to be among the favourites. Is that actually a region of Brazil? Mato Grosso? Yes, it is. And looking up the name in my Portuguese-English dictionary, I see it translates as Great Bush. That strikes me as a bit odd for the name of a region in a nation whose own name is most commonly linked nowadays with a certain cosmetic waxing procedure. Let's hasten on to the next item, shall we? Item, we all know the conventional pieties on education. Schools fail because we don't spend enough on them. We need to spend more. OK, except that the personal finance website Wallet Hub has just done a good rigorous analysis of public school spending and quality nationwide, ranking the results by state. They ranked quality on 13 different metrics, not just test scores, but also dropout rates, student-teacher ratio, bullying, safety, and so on. Key point. Washington, D.C. has the highest dropout rate, the lowest math test scores, the lowest reading test scores, and the lowest average SAT scores in the entire country. The district's overall rank on school system quality was 49th out of 51. For safety, the district ranked 51st out of 51. Yet, in per-student spending, Washington, D.C. is way up there, ranked 14th out of 51. Strange, eh? 5 years ago, I reviewed Bob Weisberg's book, Bad Students, Not Bad Schools, whose title by itself tells you most of what you need to know about public schooling in America. Nothing much has changed in these 5 years, certainly not the conventional pieties, nor the width of the gulf that separates the conventional pieties from reality. Item. Top of the New York Times hardcover bestseller lists this week is Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. I know that Radio Derb listeners are a bookish crowd who like to keep up with cutting-edge literary trends, so by kind permission of Mr. Coates' publisher, I am privileged, yes, privileged, to be able to read you a short extract from Between the World and Me. This is the dramatic opening of Chapter 849. Actual quote. Black, 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 blackety black, blackety blackety black, blackety 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 black, 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 blackety black, 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 blackety, 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 black, 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 blackety, 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 black. That's it for this week, ladies and gents. Thank you for listening and for putting up patiently with the slight glitches and adjustments as we changed hosts there. Here's a ditty to sing us out. Long-time listeners know that I have a soft spot for 19th century popular songs. Well, the other evening I finally got around to watching the 1993 Ron Maxwell movie Gettysburg. Thumbnail review. Pretty good. The battle scenes are realistically chaotic. Most of the dialogue sounds right, with only a few intrusions of late 20th century PC flapdoodle. The main historical problem is that Joshua Chamberlain's self-promotions are taken at face value. Corrective quote from Professor Guelzo, quote, "It takes nothing away from the tenacity of the fighting to say that the drama of Little Round Top has been allowed to run away with the reality. Credit for defending it belongs primarily to Gouverneur Warren, Strong Vincent and Patrick O'Rourke, and only after them to Chamberlain. But the others faded from view for reasons that left the stage open to the former Bowdoin professor." End quote. History isn't just written by the victors. It's written by those among the victors who survive to write it, and can write, and have easy access to publishers and editors, as a Bowdoin professor does. End of thumbnail movie review. The main point here is that the mid-19th century ballad, Kathleen Mavourneen, is heard in the background at a key point in the movie. That got my attention. It was one of my dad's favourites. He had a vinyl disc of the great Irish tenor John McCormack singing it. So there you are, that's our exit music for this week. More from Radio Derb next week.
The grey dawn is breaking, the horn of the hunter is heard on the hill. The lark from her light wing, the bright dew is shaking. Kathleen Mavourneen, what slumbering. How soon we must sever, oh, hast thou forgotten this day we must part? It may be for years, and it may be forever, then why art thou silent, the voice of my heart? And it may be forever, then why art thou silent, Kathleen Mavourneen?